DW Inside Europe.
Hello and welcome. I'm Kate Laycock in Germany. On today's programme, Georgia's disputed election and why it's not all over yet.
Often the observer from Georgian Dream would go into the polling booth to check that they vote for the quote-unquote right candidate. What we saw this year, though, was this going up by a huge margin. I mean, it was just overwhelming. But in addition, something new that has occurred in this election was what appears to be an organised campaign of multiple voting.
Rhetoric versus reality. Just what exactly is the EU anyway? And view from Brussels. Can the Union be Trump-proofed? That's all coming up. Listen closely, because this might just be the sound of an election being stolen. In a clip shared widely on social media, a group of muscular men with laminated accreditation tags dangling from their black jackets hastily surround a ballot box and stuff it full of paper. Around them is commotion and protest. Someone wearing an official-looking green bib steps in front of the camera. The clip ends abruptly. This happened last weekend in Georgia. No, not Georgia, USA. Georgia, the small Caucasus nation bordering Russia, Turkey, Armenia and Azerbaijan. Before polls had even closed, the ruling pro-Russian party, Georgian Dream, had declared victory. But with reports of election interference, intimidation and vote rigging pouring in from across the country, the president quickly called for protests, slamming the election as a fraud. Since then, Georgia's Electoral Commission has carried out a partial ballot recount, confirming Georgian Dream's win, and prosecutors have summoned President Zurabishvili for questioning. The president, however, stands by her claims. To understand what's just happened in Georgia, I turned once again to Robin Fabro, editor-in-chief of the news platform OC Media, which covers the North and South Caucasus region.
We had 15 journalists all over Georgia at different areas and different precincts covering the election. And all of them witnessed violations occurring, and several of them were personally harassed by these Georgian Dream Party observers in the precincts, telling them they couldn't film, trying to remove them from the polling stations, and often the election officials who are supposed to be neutral would be sort of taking their side a bit. In most of Georgia's elections in recent history, we have seen things like vote buying, intimidating voters, and violating the voter secrecy. So this is more than one person going into a polling booth. Often the observer from Georgian Dream would go into the polling booth to check that they vote for the quote-unquote right candidate. What we saw this year, though, was this going up by a huge margin. I mean, it was just overwhelming. But in addition, something new that has occurred in this election was what appears to be an organized campaign of multiple voting. We saw that the procedures for verifying that voters had not already voted were not observed properly. So this is, in Georgia, they will ink your finger. If you try to come again, they check with a UV light and you can see this person has already voted. So we saw they weren't properly inking. They weren't always checking if people were inked. And this kind of corroborates what we've seen from local observer groups who have said they've uncovered this scheme in which the election officials were in on it, certain voters were in on it who would vote multiple times over and over again for Georgian Dream. So it really looks like a kind of coordinated, very well organized rigging of this election.
And when the results came out, we saw sharp voting anomalies, and these were particularly, I believe, in rural areas.
There is a rural-urban divide politically in this country. But the extent to which we saw it in the results, it's obscene. You know, there's no way that this government that has made a lot of unpopular moves in the last 4 years got so much more of the vote share than they did in 2020. I mean, it's kind of blatant. You know, there's 55% up from 48% 4 years ago. And, you know, they just have not got more popular since then. We've seen this in opinion polling over the last 4 years, that their popularity has been slipping and slipping. So the numbers, they don't make sense at all.
To the extent that the president of Georgia, Salome Zurabishvili, was extremely quick to call for protests, and this is despite the fact that she has previously been allied with Georgian Dream.
And I think the president has gained a lot of respect, both in Georgia and internationally, for being kind of fair, you know, not this partisan figure. So when she said these elections are outright fraud, I think a lot of people are taking that seriously. And I think they should also.
So what does that look like on the ground so far?
So we saw a huge protest already where tens and thousands of people came to the streets. I think now people are waiting because the evidence keeps emerging and the opposition groups are kind of, I think they want to put forward the strongest case possible before calling for massive street action. And I do expect people to come out in the days and weeks ahead because people are upset. They feel that their votes have been stolen, that their democracy is being stolen from them. And I don't foresee any situation where we don't see massive street protests in the days ahead.
One of the first people to congratulate Georgian Dream on their supposed win was Hungarian Prime Minister Viktor Orban, who then promptly appeared in Tbilisi in person to lend his support. Can you comment on the significance of that, please, Robin?
I mean, I think your listeners will probably see the significance of that. I mean, I think Georgian Dream admires the Orban government, this kind of authoritarian, anti-Western, kind of pro-Russian, but, you know, not directly controlled maybe by Russia. This is something they would love to have, to crush dissent slowly with the pretense of democracy.
So we have Viktor Orban's Hungary as one possible path for Georgia. And the other path, I suppose that's represented by all those EU flags that have been being waved by protesters. What does the EU mean to Georgians right now, Robin?
I think people here see the EU as their future, or at least the future they want. And I mean, this support for Georgia joining the EU is so overwhelming. It's, you know, 80%+ people say in polls they would like Georgia to join the EU. And what the government is doing, it's clearly taking the country further away from that goal. This is one of the reasons I think these results, they don't make sense at all, because it's such a strong part of Georgian identity, actually, that they see themselves as being part of Europe, part of European civilization. This is how Georgians see themselves. And I mean, we'll see what the EU's reaction is. Right now, they're being very cautious, I would say, kind of not outright refusing to recognize the results. And I think also people in Georgia are watching for that. They're watching what is the EU going to say about these elections that they believe are stolen.
I'm going to end that interview with Robin Fabro, editor-in-chief at the Caucasus-focused online news platform OC Media, with the sound of the EU anthem, Beethoven's Glorious Ninth Symphony, playing as tens of thousands of protesters rally in central Tbilisi, many of them clutching EU flags. It's a sound and sight eerily reminiscent of Ukraine's Euromaidan protests of almost 10 years ago, a powerful reminder of the power the European story still holds for so many. It's a story that EU Commission President Ursula von der Leyen is herself still very fond of telling.
And it begins with the post-war generation which brought together countries divided by centuries of war.
That's her speaking just this week at the inauguration ceremony for the College of Europe campus in Tirana, Albania, offering the assembled students a vision of the European Union as a peace project, extending out inexorably into the future.
Then the post-Cold War generation, which brought together the two halves of our continent. And today's leaders' generation is trying to complete this process to finally bring all of Europe together.
But behind the rhetoric, What's the reality? Are the European waters really so untroubled? And what about the source, Brussels, where the various parliamentary factions are vying for influence ahead of EU commissioner hearings, which open next week? All questions which I put to DW's Jack Parrock.
So the centre did hold in the elections, and they did create the sort of Greens, the Socialists, the Liberals and von der Leyen's centre-right EPP party. They created their sort of coalition that approved her to return as the European Commission president. And this is why it gets quite tricky at the moment, because her EPP group is starting to seem to court some of the far-right factions. Those connected to the Hungarian Prime Minister, Viktor Orban, those connected to the Italian Prime Minister, Giorgia Meloni. And while it's actually not so much von der Leyen herself, it's the party in the European Parliament, the other political factions, those more centrist political factions, are really, really starting to kick off about it. In Brussels, and more broadly in European lawmaking, we have a thing which is called, it's a French term called the cordon sanitaire, so the sort of sanitary cordon, where the parties of the sort of centre-right, centre-left will not work with the far-right or far-left. And that appears to have started to erode, and there's a lot of discussion about what that would mean, who's doing it and why they're doing it at the moment.
And strangely, a key word here, I think, is Venezuela.
It is. And this is a weird one, right? Venezuela doesn't really have too much to do with the European Parliament. But essentially what happened when the European Parliament took a vote on where they position themselves related to that South American country, and a lot of the right-wing factors, and especially the centre-right, but also the far-right, want to be very, very critical. And what you saw is the centre-right EPP groups start to align themselves with what the far-right were saying on that, whereas the leftist factions, who are perhaps more sympathetic to a socialist outlook of the world, even if they're not in favour of what the president of Venezuela, Nicolas Maduro, is doing, it started to fray some of the edges of that traditional centrist coalition in the European Parliament. And that's why people are starting to call the other side. So if the EPP were to go with the far right, that would start to be called the Venezuela majority. That's the term that's arisen here. It's a bizarre one, but it shows the fact that even a name is being attached to this, starts to appear that cordon sanitaire that I've spoken about, that is starting to be eroded.
And of course, a crucial test of this is going to come next week when we have the hearings of the commissioners. What are the names to watch there? Give me some details, Jack.
So this is where it starts to get really complicated, because then it comes down to the other political factions. And there are a number of them. I won't bore you listing off all of the different hard right to far right factions in the European Parliament. But that's sort of how it works. So Italy's government is in a group called the European Conservatives and Reformists, which was actually started by the British Conservatives pre-Brexit. So that's a bit boring. But they're considered just slightly further right. They're not sort of really far right, like Germany's Alternative for Deutschland party would be considered. They've put forward a guy called Raffaele Fitto to be European Commissioner. There will be all eyes on him to see whether he gets through. But the broad understanding is that the European People's Party, that centrist party of von der Leyen, will actually go for him and will approve him. Generally, von der Leyen and Meloni tend to get on. They've done foreign trips together. They've worked on migration issues together. And it appears that they're kind of getting on there. The question then is Hungary's party. We've got Olivier Vaihely. He's actually been commissioner for the last 5 years. He's been put forward again by the government of the Hungarian Prime Minister Viktor Orban. They're further to the right. And the question is whether he will be approved and what that will mean as well. Behind all of this, and that's also where the questions come up, are the political players making deals? Are the EPP making deals with those harder and far right parties to sort of get things through behind the scenes rather than in the open debates? And that's what the sort of big question is. Is that cordon sanitaire being eroded in the sort of back rooms rather than in sort of public discourse, perhaps?
So crunch time for Europe on multiple fronts. Jack, thank you so much for taking the time to take me through all of that.
Yeah, I know it can be really complicated, the European Parliament.
Never apologise for your hobbies, Jack, however weird they may be.
Exactly.
This seems like a nice moment to announce some good news. Inside Europe's coverage of the 2024 EU elections, featuring Jack's Brussels brain in all its glory, has won silver in the category News Politics Best Single Episode in this year's Signal Awards. Many congratulations to all our wonderful contributors and to everyone who voted. And I want to say that I was particularly touched that so many of you actually reached out to us after voting with messages of support for our work. Your emails really meant a lot to us all, and I think probably particularly to our editor Helen Sini, who has been the driving force behind the programme for over 30 years. Sadly, next week will be Helen's last week on the show. So if any of you would like to say goodbye, do drop her a line via insideeurope@dw.com. And I promise I'll make sure that she sees your messages. She's off this week, so I can say that. Anyway, I'm Kate Laycock in Germany. You're listening to Inside Europe. And so we come full circle. Those are the sounds of burning ballots. And yes, this time we are in the USA. On Monday, hundreds of ballots were destroyed or damaged in fires set at two ballot drop boxes in the Pacific Northwest. Whilst the identity and motivations of the culprit are not yet clear, the arson attacks come in an atmosphere of suspicion and anger, fueled in no small part by former President Trump's decision to repeatedly rail against both drop-off boxes and mail-in ballots, which experts warn are part of a broader effort to cast doubt on the election results. For US citizens living in Europe, the ability to vote by mail is, of course, crucial, as Ben Batka found out when he attended a voter assistance event in Berlin.
Have you voted yet?
Yes.
Okay, so
I actually got my I voted sticker here.
Sweet. I have a question about the envelope.
Yeah. Which state is this, by the way?
Virginia.
Okay.
I need to buy the correct envelope, and then I need to print on top of that envelope, correct?
I don't personally in my head have the information about Virginia, but from votefromabroad.org, we can actually help you look that up.
Democrats Abroad, a volunteer-run organization active in 45 countries, is holding a voter assistance event at Berlin's Kollwitz Square Market. One of the volunteers is Elizabeth Wenzel. She has voted in every single US presidential election since the 1970s, but she thinks this one is the most consequential one of them all.
They know this election is important. They know what's at stake.
What is at stake?
Democracy. So many things. This election affects the whole world, not just the United States. I worked for Planned Parenthood for 15 years, and a woman's right to have health care, that's important to me. And I feel like that's at stake. The other issue that's really important to me is guns. I have grandchildren in the American school system. I have two children that teach in the American school system. And every day, I am anxious about gun violence.
Wenzel is one of some 4.4 million Americans who live overseas. Close to 3 million of them are eligible to vote. Around 20,000 currently reside in the German capital. The voter turnout among Americans abroad has historically been abysmal. In 2020, the estimate was around 8% globally. Stateside citizens were approximately 8 times more likely to vote. Democrats are hoping that the anti-Trump factor will increase turnout. But will it be enough to overcome the disillusionment being expressed by voters like this one?
My whole life I've been raised to be like, I'm a Democrat. The Republicans are evil. And I think as I've gotten older and just learned more, I've realized that there's difference and in the same way there's not difference. For example, with the war in Palestine, the Democrats aren't doing anything. They're still sending billions of dollars of weapons to Israel. I don't want to vote for a party that doesn't care about human rights and doesn't care about human lives.
That's Savita. She moved to Berlin from California in 2021 with her partner, Noah.
Policy is in line with top 10% of income earners in the US, but there's just no correlation between public policy and public opinion. At the core issues, right, like things that are actually affecting people's lives, you know, increasing taxes, having more social services, all this stuff, Republicans and Democrats, they are more or less the same with minor details because they're bankrolled by the same people. The corporations pay both of them.
Trump is worse on different topics like trans rights, women's rights. His Project 2025 is pretty terrible.
Drafted by the Conservative Heritage Foundation, Project 2025 is a 900-page policy wish list for the next Republican president that would expand presidential power and impose an ultra-conservative social vision. Among other things, it proposes mass deportations of undocumented migrants, replacing thousands of government employees with political appointees, and the elimination of the Department of Education. Brett Morrison, a conservative who voted for Trump from Berlin, is neither concerned about the blueprint's far-reaching aims nor about people questioning Trump's fitness and character.
No, I'm not so scared about what 2025 or if he implements most of it, because most of it is probably good. I mean, we don't. I was in Washington, D.C. recently over the summer, and the size of those buildings, the U.S. Department of Education, is just massive. And you look through the windows and you see people sitting behind computers. You know, the overhead drain is ridiculous. So take away the Department of Education, it seems very extreme. I would love to see him do it.
Asked about widespread fears that, in case of an election loss, Trump will not accept the results, Morrison says he believes that the Democrats are also likely to challenge the count.
To think that the DNC and the RNC aren't geared up to challenge this election when it's close, they're both going to be doing it. Okay. I hope that that's not the case. I hope that on the election day, and this is really a vital point, that I hope it's a decisive victory.
The Harris campaign has given no indication that it is preparing to challenge results. In contrast, Donald Trump has repeatedly announced his belief that the only legitimate outcome is the one wherein he emerges as the clear winner, like at this rally in Michigan in September.
If I lose, I'll tell you what's possible, because they cheat. That's the only way we're going to lose, because they cheat. They cheat like hell.
All of this rhetoric, this narrative, gives him a sort of stage in order to question the result.
That's Constance Chukolowski, chair of the Berlin chapter of Dems Abroad. She worries that rhetoric like this, coupled with a new wave of Republican lawsuits challenging the legitimacy of overseas ballots, may have discouraged some Americans abroad from ordering their postal votes.
This narrative will certainly have impacted whether or not some people request their ballots at all. It intimidates, it scares people. They think, oh, am I even allowed to do this? The hurdles to voting abroad are many, and he did that at a very strategic time in the election. Trump has laid the groundwork to make November 6th, 7th, 8th, 9th really, really challenging days for us. It's something I'm fearful of.
Americans abroad who are still trying to make their vote count are running out of time. About half of all stays require that election officials receive absentee ballots by the end of Election Day, November 5th. The other half will accept ballots from abroad postmarked by Election Day and received within a set period after polls closed. To be on the safe side, voters can also dispatch a federal write-in absentee ballot, also known as an emergency or backup ballot. If both ballots arrive before the deadline, the election office will count only the official ballot. Ben Bartke, DW, Berlin.
The address for federal absentee ballots is fvap.gov, and we wish all our US listeners a fair and peaceful election. This is Inside Europe, and I'm Kate Laycock in Germany. This is Inside Europe. I'm Kate Laycock in Germany. In the next half hour, two very different European perspectives on the US election. One from Brussels.
Everyone still has traumatic memories of how harshly Trump treated European allies in his first term. And he's been promising to do more of that.
The other from Turkey.
I cannot imagine what type of chemistry Harris and Erdogan would have. They don't come from similar backgrounds. It's difficult to imagine the two developing a very close personal relationship, to be honest.
After that, the agonizing fall of a once great German auto giant, and Spain finds itself on the front lines of Europe's climate emergency once again.
Broadcasting from Germany, this is Inside Europe.
Perhaps never before has a US election been so closely watched in Europe. With just days to go before the vote, Brussels is all aflutter as the full political implications of what is about to take place across the Atlantic begin to dawn on EU lawmakers. Our Brussels correspondent and security expert, Terry Schultz, herself a US-American, has been in the thick of it all, trying to sift through the panic and projections. We spoke on Wednesday.
Well, Kate, of course, the conventional wisdom is that Europe always favors Democrats, who are seen as closer to European values when it comes to things like social spending, the importance of the transatlantic relationship, you know, the crucial position of NATO at the center of that relationship, all those things. And that's, of course, even more true this time, as everyone still has traumatic memories of how harshly Trump treated European allies in his first term. And he's been promising to do more of that, talking about higher tariffs on European goods, about distancing the U.S. even more from NATO. You know, he's said he's possibly only willing to defend fellow NATO allies if they pay at least the NATO goal of 2% of GDP on defense. He talks a lot about China, as he did in his first term, demanding loyalty from Europeans to his view on China. I could go on.
Right. OK, so we have many, many reasons for European politicians to favour a Harris win over a Trump win. And you did say at the beginning that the conventional wisdom is that Europe always favours Democrats. However, Europe isn't an ever steady monolith. It is undergoing shifts of its own. Could it be that the story is not quite as simple as some people may believe from the outside?
Well, Trump will probably find more friendly views here in Europe than the first time he was in office, because, as you say, Europe itself has shifted to the right. I mean, look at Hungarian Prime Minister Viktor Orban, who is constantly talking about his very close friendship with Trump. And Trump, which I always find very amusing because nobody will know who Viktor Orban is in the U.S., but Trump continually mentions Viktor Orban, who is not a household name in the United States, but he thinks that that's somehow important for his campaign to talk about how close he is to some Europeans. And, you know, there have been a lot of right-wing members of the European Parliament elected now. So, truthfully, there won't be as many people who are offended by Trump's views of Europe as there were the first term. And, you know, there are even voices that are saying that, you know, maybe it would be good for us as Europe that a Trump presidency would shock us into doing some of the things that we need to do anyway. Well, for one thing, he would be on the side of the right wing parties when it comes to immigration. So they would have backup in that way. But also, you know, Europe is not united on a lot of things. So if you have sort of a Trump attack coming from the outside, maybe Europe will be able to coalesce around a single European view. Where that lies related to the center, we don't know, depending on the issue. That would be true on defense spending. He pushed them very hard once and will do so again. And those who would like to see Europe take a harder view on China, that will be something that a Trump presidency will push Europe to do, as it did the first time.
So Trump is likely to find allies within Europe, and that's despite the fact that he threatens measures that will be very hard on Europe, like potential tariffs on cars, for example, or, as you mentioned, crucially, Ukraine. He would want to cut off aid to Ukraine.
Yeah, he has threatened that, as well as his, of course, promise to end the war in 24 hours, which everyone sees as basically giving Putin whatever he wants to end the war. And these tariffs, though, like, you know, politicians who may find that, feel that they are in line with Trump will not like the cost of U.S. tariffs on European goods. Trump put those through on aluminum and steel the first time through. It was, you know, a trade war that still hasn't been resolved that started his first term. So I think that they will not be happy with those. This is going to be difficult for people. But, you know, most of what we find is actually politicians trying to straddle the views. They're worried that if they said something negative about Trump in particular now, he would come back to punish them because he has been quite retaliatory toward anybody who criticizes him. And one of the most stark examples of this came when Mark Rutte took over as the new Secretary General on October 1st. Now, he's somebody who has a bit of a history with Trump, but not entirely a bad one. Listen to what he had to say about the two U.S. candidates when he was asked.
I worked with Donald Trump for 4 years. I've been in close talks with Kamala Harris. I respect them both very much. I am absolutely convinced that on this issue, they both see what is necessary. And when you take, for example, President Trump, thanks to him, we pushed up the defense spending. We sped up the defense spending since the summit here in 2018 particularly. But also what he said on China is now very much taken on board, I think, by many of us. Kamala Harris has a record as vice president and now as a candidate in defending American values.
Terry, that really is quite an extraordinary clip.
It is, and it raised a lot of eyebrows because Rutte was so positive about Trump and said very little about Harris. Either way, he basically just said, yeah, she's the vice president, and I know her, you know, from that. So that was really interesting. But when you talk to people at NATO, even ones that, you know, wouldn't necessarily be on the liberal side of things, they are very worried about the threats to cut off U.S. aid. He can't probably really pull the U.S. out of NATO, but he can freeze a lot of movements of U.S. troops to Europe. There are now U.S. troops on the front line with Russia. Those are really important for those countries, and those countries are very afraid about a Trump presidency.
Terry, I hope you don't mind me sort of ending by making it a little bit personal, because I'm talking to you, of course, as our Brussels and our security correspondent, but you are American. How are you experiencing this election personally?
Kate, are you a licensed therapist? Because I don't know if I should go into this with you. You know, without expressing preference for either candidate, I think that it has been so alarming to watch this election and to hear the things that are said on the campaign trail. The amount of disinformation in this campaign is unbelievable. The fact that AI has been used to distort political messages is very disturbing. Everybody knows that this is coming in this world we live in, but, you know, we've seen it now. And I think it's very scary. And, you know, Kate, just before we're talking, I got off a call that was with our Washington Bureau, and they were talking about how worried they are about their physical security. DW has had to pay for extra security to keep people safe because of the risk of violence. And they basically said it like it's a given that, you know, there will probably be violence after the vote. And it is just shocking. Even after we saw, you know, the January 6th insurrection, the idea that we don't know the extent to which this could happen after this vote. This is just something that shouldn't be happening in the United States, and it is. So having nothing to do with which candidate I may want or may not want, those are the things that I worry about as an American, and they're really heartbreaking.
I'm going to leave the interview there since, as Terry Schultz herself pointed out, I am no therapist, and there is, as yet, no closure. Now, Turkey is always something of an outlier in Europe, not just geographically, straddling as it does two continents with one foot in Europe and the other in Asia, but also politically. So how is the US election being viewed from Ankara? Well, it's complicated. On the one hand, it's widely assumed that President Erdogan nurtures a strong personal preference for Trump. On the other hand, it may be a case of be careful what you wish for, as Dorian Jones reports.
and we will make America great again. God bless.
With US presidential elections entering the last week, analysts say Ankara will see the outcome as key to Turkish-US relations, given the expected different approaches of Donald Trump and Kamala Harris towards Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan. Sinan Ülgen heads the Center for Economics and Foreign Policy Studies, an Istanbul think tank.
Ankara seems to be particularly silent about these elections, but in reality, there is a proclivity for a Trump win, essentially because during the past Trump presidency, the political relationship at the highest level between Erdogan and Trump was a strong one, whereas nowadays, between Biden and Erdogan, and if Kamala Harris wins, between Harris and Erdogan, is likely to be a much more shallow one.
Erdogan has avoided commenting on the US election. But during Trump's presidency, he met with him 9 times, including on a state visit to Washington. In contrast, Erdogan has only met President Biden briefly on the sidelines of international summits, with US-Turkish relations mainly conducted at a foreign minister level. A frustrating situation for a leader who sees personal contact as key to achieving his goals, says international relations professor Serhat Güvenç of Istanbul's Kadir Has University.
It's very important for his domestic standing and legitimacy. He has built a personalized system, but also convinced his voters, particularly his base, that he is a consequential leader, that Turkey is rising, that it's very important. He is on par with the US president and the Russian president, that everybody is looking up to Erdogan. I cannot imagine what type of chemistry Harris and Erdogan would have. They don't come from similar backgrounds. It's difficult to imagine the two developing a very close personal relationship, to be honest.
Such interaction, especially with the most powerful person in the world, is also vital for Erdogan domestically, claims Asla Aydintaşbaş of the Washington-based Brookings Institution.
Erdogan has been in power for more than 20 years, and Biden is the only US president who has refused to meet him in an official capacity, either in the U.S. capital or in the Turkish capital. Before Trump, every U.S. president had visited Turkey. And probably, he thinks, deep down, he thinks that he can, sort out many things through personal connections or through personal engagement.
Erdogan has often spoken warmly of his relationship with Trump, despite the fact he got hit by sanctions over the purchase of Russian missiles while Trump was in the White House. Trump once even threatened to, in his words, totally destroy and obliterate the Turkish economy over Turkey's threats to attack US-backed Syrian Kurdish forces, prompting the Turkish lira to crash. Trump is calling for more support for Israel in its wars against Hamas and Hezbollah, and analysts say differences could again emerge between the US and Turkish leaders. Özgür Ünlü Hüsükçükle heads the German Marshall Fund office in Ankara.
President Trump's approach to the Middle East and the conflict between the Palestinians and Israel could actually, escalate the tension in the Middle East to the extent that a regional war could be unavoidable. So yes, a Trump presidency has many opportunities for Turkey, but it's very high risk.
While there has been little contact between Biden and Erdogan, Turkish-US relations have shown signs of improvement, with the two NATO allies increasingly cooperating and better managing differences. Analysts say there are merits for Ankara to both candidates. Aydintaşbaş of the Brookings Institution in Washington.
Kamala Harris administration would mean more continuity, but promise of a stability in Turkish-US relations, whereas Trump is so unpredictable that it could be very good, very bad, very good one day and very bad one day.
As the war in the Middle East spreads, the risk to Ankara of an unpredictable Trump presidency increase. Nevertheless, Erdogan will still likely covet the opportunity of renewing his relationship with a man he still perceives as someone he can do business with. Dorian Jones, DW, Istanbul.
And that concludes our pre-US election coverage from a European perspective. Next week, we will, of course, know more. That's here on Inside Europe with me, Kate Laycock.
European politics. It's complicated, right?
Luckily, there's a podcast that helps make sense of it.
It's called The Europeans.
Every week, we break down the biggest stories in European politics.
Can I disagree slightly with the premise of your question?
Go for it.
I think some European leaders may actually prefer Donald Trump.
And some quirky non-political stories you probably missed.
Vilnius, the G-spot of Europe. Nobody knows where it is, but once you find it, it's amazing.
The Europeans.
New episodes every Thursday.
We need to talk about Volkswagen. The German car giant is in trouble, big trouble, and that has social, political and economic consequences that ripple out well beyond the confines of the so-called VW family. Luckily, the most business-savvy member of the Inside Europe team has been working with me this week, so here is Nick Martin with this explainer.
German engineering at its best.
Volkswagen, BMW, Audi, Mercedes.
Volkswagen for all.
German car brands that have become synonymous with quality and superior engineering. In 2022, the automotive industry generated about half a trillion euros in sales and contributed about 5% to Germany's GDP. But that world-class reputation is fast becoming unstuck. Last year, sales plummeted by 10%. Faced with a severe slump in profits, the world's largest automaker, Volkswagen, plans to scale back its domestic manufacturing, which unions say will mean factory closures, mass layoffs and wage cuts. Here's how DW's business reporter Maria Sina explained VW's change of fortunes to PRI's The World.
People in Europe and people in Germany aren't buying enough cars, and especially not enough electric cars. On the other hand, Germany no longer has access to cheap Russian energy, so that means higher manufacturing costs than abroad. We're looking at China, VW's most important market, where sales of German cars are declining. Buyers in China are looking towards homegrown brands to buy. And then lastly, we have the US, where presidential candidates are talking about tariffs, which is, of course, an unpleasant thought for a company like Volkswagen.
VW's woes have been made worse by the German government ending subsidies for new electric vehicles, a deciding factor when some consumers remain reticent about the new technology. Berlin is now under pressure to reinstate the subsidies, despite budget pressures from a sluggish economy. Having built their reputations on the back of combustion engine vehicles, German carmakers were initially sceptical about whether electric cars would take off and are now struggling to play catch-up. The Dieselgate emissions scandal also cost VW and others billions. The Chinese, meanwhile, took the lead in electric vehicle production and are now accused by the European Union of dumping cheap cars on the European market. Peter Bofinger, an economist at Germany's Würzburg University, thinks the China issue won't go away anytime soon.
Even if the quality of the German cars is comparable with Chinese cars, there's also the problem of the price. And for the same quality, Chinese cars are much cheaper. And I do not see, for the time being, how German cars can become as competitive in the Chinese markets. In addition, we have now to fear that Chinese cars will enter the German car market. And so this is really a very difficult problem and difficult to solve because trends have been neglected by the car producers and also by German politicians.
Germany's car industry employs nearly 800,000 people and hundreds of thousands more along the vast manufacturing supply chain. Their bumper wage packets and union-protected jobs have helped fuel growth for decades. So with the potential closure of three plants and the scaling back of several others, DW's business reporter Maria Sina thinks the ripple effects will be felt across the country.
A job at Volkswagen used to be a safe bet here in Germany, a ticket into the middle class, essentially, relatively high pay and very safe conditions for decades. And now this is changing rapidly. We're talking about plant closures, tens of thousands of job cuts and shaving salaries by 10%. This will reverberate across the entire German economy because you have entire towns built around these Volkswagen plants.
Aber mit Forderungen.
Forderungen konfrontiert. Es geht dabei um
the mood at VW's headquarters in Wolfsburg was somber this week as the company remained tight-lipped about plant closures and job cuts, but did confirm talks were underway to slash pay.
The problem with the management is that it has known these problems now for almost 20 months, yet it did not present any innovative solution, except that costs have to be cut and that employees allegedly caused the problems. It feels like they have absolutely no plan and no one knows what's going on in their heads. I believe this encourages the frustration and the fear even more, apart from what is happening right now.
These are very drastic cuts and they obviously cause fear. We have to see how we can feed our families and what's next for this region, since this has personal consequences, but also impacts for the region and in fact for Germany.
And having already been targeted by former US President Donald Trump during his first term, German carmakers will be under pressure, if Trump wins a second term in the White House, to increase their US production or face import tariffs in the world's second largest car market. As the likes of VW attempt to become more nimble, Germans are now preparing to tighten their belts and hope that new growth sectors can take their place and create enough middle-class jobs for future generations. Nick Martin, DW.
Having just spoken about cars, let's talk about the climate. And yes, sadly, there is a connection. You've probably seen the images coming out of Spain's Valencia region. A raging torrent of brown water ripping through what once were streets, surging through people's homes, dumping cars into apocalyptic pile-ups and leaving desperate people calling for help from their roofs and balconies. Rescuers have been working around the clock, but as of recording, at least 95 people are confirmed dead, with many more missing, and another storm warning is pending further north. The week's belief-defying rainfall. One of the towns affected reported 1 year's worth of rainfall on Tuesday in just a period of 8 hours, put Spain right back at the forefront of the European climate crisis. And that's after another scorching summer accompanied by wildfires, drought and disease. The disease in question is an infection known as West Nile virus, which can be passed on to humans via mosquito bites. Now, as the name suggests, the disease's origins are not actually European, but as the continent becomes hotter, outbreaks, like the one which has claimed 9 lives so far this year in Spain, are becoming more likely. Inside Europe's Ashish Sharma has more on the story.
The latest news reports on Spanish TV in Andalusia in the south of Spain highlight the concerns of citizens living in the areas most affected by the West Nile virus. Spain's Public Health Alert Service, with official figures from the Health Ministry, states that there are 98 infections so far, with 8 fatalities. The president of the Andalusia government, Juanma Moreno, has also been facing tough questions as to why, once again, the region faces not only the most infections, but also the most deaths.
So the question is, West Nile virus is a problem not only in Spain, it's a problem in Europe.
Jordi Figuerola, who's leading the investigation into the virus in Andalusia for the government agency, the National Spanish Research Council, says that part of the problem is to do with cultivation.
The two outbreaks, big outbreaks, the one in 2020 and the other, the one that is running now in 2024, have in common that they started in areas surrounding rice field cultivation areas, and in particular to the lack of enough effective methods to control the mosquitoes in the area.
What is it that the region is not doing correct in terms of infrastructure that they really need to get right that you're very concerned about?
The responsibility of mosquito management in the cities is the responsibility of the municipalities. Often these municipalities are too small to face the big problem of mosquitoes that may occur in areas that are very close to these rice field areas. We need to adopt mosquito control programs that kill the mosquitoes when they are larving and when they are at the rice fields. And then the problems start because the farmers are not incentivated to use products, biocides, that only kill mosquitoes, because the mosquitoes is not a problem for the rice production. And the other problem is that it must be applied when nobody cares of the mosquitoes and nobody cares of West Nile virus, because you must start when the mosquitoes are larvae. So really what we need is the farmers and these local and regional administrations to sit together and to decide how they will do the control in these areas.
Unlike, say, malaria, which only affects humans, West Nile virus is also found in animals and birds, so controlling the mosquitoes is much harder. As a result, across Europe, the virus is also impacting other countries. Dr. Manuel Linares, an expert in tropical and infectious diseases, says the ideal would be to have a coordinated medical approach to the problem, but that this is not easy.
We are doing very good things in control some disease like dengue, like malaria, but we have a big problem because we have empty informative from some countries. Look at the map of Europe, the countries of the south of Europe, but the north of Africa, what's happened there? They have cases too. The monitoring of the disease is very difficult. Some countries and governments don't give information about that. So we have to work together to make a big plan with countries that don't have the same economic power that, like Europe. So I think the problem nowadays is not Spain, it's the north of Africa or other countries that have the disease, and perhaps it's where you have to do that politics from control vector or mosquitoes. No?
My name is Tomáš Bakonyi, and I'm principal expert at the European Center for Disease Prevention and Control. We have been experiencing outbreaks of West Nile virus infections in humans and in animals in the past 20 years, which is now affecting more than half of the European countries. Climate change is a very important component of this global ecological crisis, which is also including the changes in the land use, the agricultural activities, the population growth globally, migration of humans, migrations of animals, and so on. And vector-borne diseases are much more widespread and much more frequent in tropical areas. And in those areas, the climate change can have an effect of the locally endemic diseases. And if there are larger outbreaks of these diseases in the tropical areas, there is an increasing risk of importation of diseases to Europe.
West Nile virus has now established itself here in Europe, and because it also affects animals and birds, it won't be possible to eradicate. The solution here for countries like Spain, which are most affected, is to take early measures to reduce it from spreading. But as climate impact continues to change our environment, the concern is that other viruses will soon also appear over the horizon. Ashish Sharma, DW, Madrid.
And with Azerbaijan preparing to host COP29 this November, you can expect plenty more environmental coverage here on Inside Europe. So do subscribe to our podcast feed to make sure that you don't miss it. For additional coverage, we recommend our sister podcast, Living Planet.
There's a lot of wonder to be found on our planet.
I stare up at the shapes created by the tangled webs of its spindly yet copious branches. And I often find myself wondering about all the other people who've stood or sat where I do.
A planet full of so much life. Travel the world with us as we marvel at amazing landscapes. Subscribe to Living Planet wherever you listen to podcasts.
And that's it for today. This programme was produced by me, Kate Laycock, with help from Nick Martin and sound engineers Moritz Vogt and Jürgen Kuhn. I'm Kate Laycock. Inside Europe comes to you from DW in Bonn, Germany.